Yes, thank you, Ira, for that very kind introduction. I also want to express my gratitude and my admiration to Ira for the organization, Stucca Inc. Certainly, at a time when we are literally overwhelmed with so many demands, and it's almost impossible to sort out what is a more worthy cause than another, and how do you prioritize the giving of Stucca, which, after all, is absolutely essential. This is one of the few organizations in the world that really allows people to make an informed judgment as to where they should allocate their funds. Obviously, Stucca Inc. does not make recommendations. It is your decision where to give, but you're not in a position to make that decision unless you know what the organization does, how much goes to overhead and administrative costs. So we owe him a tremendous yasher koach to enable the fulfillment of the mitzvah of tzedakah with intelligence, with discretion, and with judgment, instead of blindly throwing our money, or not throwing our money, as it were, to the causes that need it the most. The mitzvah of tzedakah is certainly one of the greatest mitzvahs that we have in Klal Yisrael. The Jewish people are distinguished by their rachmanut, by their compassion, by their concern for others. And it's very interesting that the very word tzedakah, which we normally translate as charity, does not really mean charity. It is much more closely related to the word tzedek, which is justice. Charity implies my money is my own property, I do with it what I want, and if I want to be a nice person, I throw it to those that are in need. That's not exactly the way it works. Rather, it's a matter of justice. If God gives us resources, God gives us resources so we will help those people that are in need. We have a moral, religious, halakhic obligation to share the wealth and the blessing that God has given us with those who are less fortunate. We read in the Torah that if we take care of the widow, the orphan, the stranger, etc., so God says, you take care of my people, you take care of my family, the widow, the orphan, the stranger, the Levite, then I will take care of you, your spouse, your son, and your daughter. It's four against four. Take care of my four, I'll take care of your four. In many ways, we are told that tzedakah is like a medicine for the soul. You know, people say, well, how come there are so many demands made on me? Well, it's like a person who has the sickness of a soul, and they need to take medicine four times a day, five times a day. Whatever their soul needs is the amount of medicine that God sends to them. If we need more tzedakah, perhaps it's because we need to cure more illnesses of our soul. So this mitzvah of tzedakah is extremely important. The Beis Halevi writes in a very startling metaphor that we should treat those who come to us in need as if they are a lulav or an esrog or a pair of tefillin. We do mitzvahs with them. They help us gain olam haba. We should treasure them. We should love them, we should care about them, because they are our key to achieve Olam Haba. My goal tonight is to be somewhat relentlessly practical and to kind of give you some halakhic overviews of what are the duties of tzedakah and how do we navigate some of the conflicts and priority problems that all of us face. And I'm going to answer a series of questions, some at greater length, some at lesser length, and then I'll be open to other questions that people might have. How much charity must a person try to give every year? Well, that's a fairly simple answer. There actually is a halachic minimum. Chazal talk about a person must give a third of a shekel every year. That's pretty low, but in contemporary language, that translates to approximately $5. So every person, no matter how poor you are, must give at least $5 a year to charity. I assume that most of us, thank God, are able to satisfy that minimum. The virtuous amount is 20%. A virtuous person who will be able to take care of their family should actually strive, it's not a requirement, but should strive to give 20%. That's a chomesh. One is actually discouraged from generally giving more, unless they're Bill Gates or an extraordinarily wealthy person, but one should strive for a fifth. But for most people, the halacha encourages, I don't say it's an absolute requirement, but the halacha encourages that we give at least 10% of our earnings to charitable needs. This is called ma'aser. According to most opinions, the obligation of giving ma'aser from income is not a Torah requirement, nor is it even a rabbinic requirement, but it is a long-standing custom practiced by virtuous people who recognize the importance of tzedakah, and therefore I would certainly urge everybody in this room who is able to afford it, if you can strive for the chomesh, for the 20%, that's even better, but at least one should certainly give the ma'aser. Now, interestingly enough, although in the Shulchan Aruch there are laws regarding tzedakah generally, there are no particular laws regarding the giving of ma'aser. And as a result, it is a surprisingly complicated institution, just as we have the Internal Revenue Code that deals with issues, what is income, what is a deductible expense, what is a credit against tax. We have the identical halachic problems with maser on income. Maser on income is essentially a mandatory income tax. And we have our own Internal Revenue Code as to how do you calculate maser obligations. The Shulchan Aruch gives us very little guidance. And as a result, the only real source for this are the various responsa, and even of that there are not too many. There are some books in English, in particular, that you might find useful. Rabbi Avraham Feuer wrote a book for Art Scroll called the Tzedakah Anthology, which is a very good book. The Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists, around 25 years ago, published an English book on Maaser of Income, by Professor Cyril Dam, and there are a few other books as well. But I'm going to summarize this the same way we would have an income tax seminar, so to speak. And that is, if a person is supposed to give, let's work with the 10%, because that's the standard. A person has to give 10% of income. The question becomes, what type of income do we include in the calculation of the maaser obligation? We include salary, obviously. We include dividends on investment property. We include interest. Interestingly enough, there is a rule that in calculating your income for your 10% tax, you may deduct from that income business expenses and business losses. Again, it sounds like mamish like a tax calculation. If, for example, I had stock that I purchased at $100 and I sold it for $200, so I have a $100 gain on that stock, but there was another stock that I purchased for $100 and I sold for $80 at a $20 loss, I can set aside that $20 loss against my $100 gain, giving me a net gain of only $80, so my maaser obligation is only $8 rather than $10. So if you want to be exact about this, and we actually are encouraged to do so, you take your business losses. Similarly, you exclude business expenses. This would include, now this is a little broader than the IRS. Under IRS law, you cannot deduct commuting expenses as a business expense, right? If I take public transportation or my gasoline bill or the wear and tear on my car, going from my home to my place of business, all of you probably know that that is not a deductible business expense for income tax purposes. That actually is a deductible expense for maaser purposes, because it does involve an expense that was incurred in the process of generating income. In fact, it even goes to the idea that if a person travels and has to eat in restaurants on a business trip, so he could deduct from his income the incremental extra cost of the restaurant meal over the cost of the food he would normally incur at home. So if at home the value of my supper is $20, and in the restaurant it is $40, I have a $20 deduction against my income as an extra business expense. Income taxes are considered to be, even if they're personal income taxes, are actually deductible, which actually means that the maaser obligation is based on after-tax income. Although if you then get a tax refund, you have to give 10% of that to charity, but initially you can deduct your income tax. Interestingly enough, sales tax and property tax is not deductible, and the distinction is an income tax is a tax that is levied on your production of income, and therefore it is a cost of doing business. It is a cost of my engaging in business activities, as opposed to a sales tax that is a consumption tax, so to speak, That is not a tax on production of income. That is a tax on the using of income. And consequently, sales tax and property tax, unless, of course, it's for business-related property, would not be excludable. So once again, if you want to be exact about this, there is a whole detailed cheshbon of what expenses are deductions against income, what expenses are not. We actually can have seminars in halachic tax law, because that's exactly what this maser is about. Let me mention a few more exclusions that are significant, and that is non-monetary gifts. Let's take a bar mitzvah boy, right? Very, very simple. A bar mitzvah boy, a bas mitzvah girl, gets money for their bar mitzvah, bas mitzvah. Well, now that they're adults, they should clearly give 10% of that money to charity, right? That's maser like anything else. If I get a gift, I should give 10%. If they get a gift, they should give 10%. But what if they don't get a gift of money? What if they get a gift of books, of svarim? Right? It's the old problem of people in game shows, right? If you win a car or something, you may have to sell the car because you got to pay a tax. Well, do you have to give maser on gifts that you receive that are not monetary? If I get $500 of Jewish svarim or whatever, do I have to write out a check for $50? That could be a big hardship. Wedding gifts, right? If I get china and I get appliances, do I have to write out 10% of that value? Most poskim say no. Most poskim say there is no obligation to pay the maser until the asset has been reduced into cash. So if I sell my car, I got to pay 10% of the profit that I make. If I sell my stock, I got to pay 10% of the profit that I make. But if my stock simply appreciates and it has not yet been realized or concretized into a cash flow, or anything else, if property has not been liquidated to create cash, there is no din of maser. So if somebody gives me a car, I don't pay the maser tax until I sell the car. And then, of course, since it's all profit for me because I have no cost in the car, I do have to pay 10% of the total price that I received. So there is a principle which is akin to a tax principle of realization that the mere transfer of an asset that does not yet produce cash does not trigger a maser obligation. By the same token, if somebody pays my bills for me, interestingly enough, let's assume somebody gives me a gift by paying my rent, by paying my utilities, whatever it would be, but the money was not given to me to control or to have domination over, I am not obligated to give 10% of that benefit. Because although it's a real benefit, but I only give maser off cash in which I have unfettered control to spend as I wish, that which was paid by another for a specific purpose is not considered income over which I have control and domination, therefore there is no obligation to pay maser. For that reason, employer-funded pension plans. If your employer sets aside money for your benefit in a pension plan, and you don't have access to that money, one does not pay any maser. On the other hand, if you decide to voluntarily make contributions from your income into a retirement plan, that is income, although it might be tax-deferred, it's not necessarily maser-deferred, because it's your choice, it's your money, you have the power to spend it as you wish. Loan payments, if you borrow money for business purposes, then it is not only the interest that is deductible from income, which is true under federal law, it is also the principal. In other words, principal and interest payments for business loans are treated as business expenses. It's a little different than tax law, and therefore they do reduce your maser base. Again, we could talk about this even longer. I don't want to spend too much time on it. But there is a point, in other words, at which the very definition of what is income is a complicated one. And one should recognize that in computing what my income base is for my annual maaser obligation, I can take into account a variety of expenses in reducing that obligation. I'm not giving you this information to encourage people to give less. That would not be my goal. But rather, if people recognize that indeed the 10% is subject to a definition of income, perhaps that will encourage more people to strive to give the maaser than they otherwise would, if you realize that indeed there's a whole series of deductions that can be taken into account. Sometimes we tend to give maaser not in one lump sum, we give tzedakah throughout the year. Now, it may turn out that at the end of the year, if we make an accounting, we may discover that we have given more charity than we were obligated to give. There are many opinions that actually say there can be a carryover to the next year, meaning to say, if I gave more, if I gave, well, of course, I should ideally give 20%. Let's assume I gave 25%. That 5% can be carried over as a credit to my next year maaser obligation, right? So maybe we should talk about the Jewish, maybe I will want this job, commissioner of internal maaser distributions to determine how carryovers work and the like. Now, a very interesting question. This was actually a question that I did receive from email before this talk, and that is, let's talk about not the income definition, but the payment of the maaser itself. Now, normally we give charity by writing checks, by giving money. But can a person be yotze his obligation of maaser by contributing services? Right, let's assume that I'm a lawyer and I provide legal services for the indigent at no cost or at a reduced cost, or I contribute some property of mine. I have a car that I give to the yeshiva, etc. Can that be a charge, as it were? Can that be a payment towards my maaser obligation? The short answer is yes, but it's a bit tricky because you have to think out the numbers. Let me give you an example. Let's imagine that a person wants to contribute appreciated property. So let's assume a person bought a stock at $100 a share, and the stock is now $500 a share, and they want to give that $500 stock to a charitable organization. So the question is, how much maaser can they deduct? In other words, how much can that reduce their maaser bill? Now, the orientation of halakha is very commonsensical, and that is, we're not going to treat you any better than if you have sold the stock for $500 and then given the $500 to charity, meaning to say, let's imagine this. If I sold the stock for $500, I would already owe a certain amount of maaser anyway, because if my cost basis was 100 and I sold it for 500, so my profit is 400, on that 400, I owe maaser $40, which means if I would have sold the stock, took the money, I would owe maaser $40 anyway. So consequently, I would only get an additional deduction of $460. In other words, I wouldn't be able to deduct against my outstanding maaser obligation the whole 500 because I would owe $40 based on 10% of the profit. So consequently, the halacha requires that you make that same hypothetical calculation if instead of selling the stock, you donate the stock outright. In other words, what that means is you're entitled to deduct as a charge against your maaser bill your cost of the stock and 90% of the appreciation, but you cannot deduct 10% of the appreciation because that is exactly what you already would have owed anyway. Okay, it's a little complicated, but the basic formula is fairly simple. When you donate appreciated property, you can charge against your existing maaser obligation as a credit the cost that you have in the object and 90% of the appreciation, but not 10% of the appreciation because that already belongs to the tzedakah accounts. Okay, so that's how you deal with appreciation of property. Now, payment of maaser by donation of services works the same way. Again, just figure this out. The halacha basically says, when I give services, that's tantamount to my being paid and then giving the money back. So let's imagine that my hourly rate is $250. My rate is not that high, but let's assume that that is the rate. Now, if I donate an hour of free service, halacha looks at it as if I was paid $250, And then I gave the $250 to charity. Now let's figure that out. If I was paid $250, I already owe charity $25 because that's income. So if I then give the $250, the only credit I get against the balance of my charity obligation is $225, which is 90% of what I got. So consequently, if instead of getting the money and giving it to charity, I simply donate my service, halacha requires that you look at it as if you got paid and then gave it away to charity, which means, in other words, you only get a 90%, or if your custom is chomesh, you only get an 80% credit against your maaser bill. Okay, I hope this is clear. It's a little bit complicated. The point is that when you give tzedakah by appreciated property, or you give tzedakah by donated services, you do have to take off the 10% that you would have to give to maaser had you actually received the money and then given it to charity. The logic is very compelling, because halacha is not going to give you a bigger break if you provide the service than if you were paid for the service and then gave away the check. It makes no sense economically to treat the two transactions in a different way, and therefore halacha treats it the same. Donating services is treated as if you got the money, gave it away to charity, and since 10% belongs to the charity account anyway, you only get an extra 90% to charge against your maaser bill. Okay. Interestingly enough, patronizing poor people who are selling some type of item, well, I'll discuss who is a poor person, that's an important question, can count as maaser, but only to the extent you're paying more than you would pay from alternative sources. So for example, let's assume I want to buy a piece of furniture. So I can get it for $100 in a regular place, but if I buy it from a person who is in desperate straits, it's going to cost me $200. Now under those circumstances, it is only the extra money I'm paying to go to a poor person that counts as a maaser payment. Which means, in other words, if the poor person is charging me less, I get no maaser at all because I'm actually benefiting from the transaction. If the poor person is charging me more, a premium, as it were, then the extra money that I'm paying over and above what it would cost me to get that service later, that does count as a maaser obligation. So we've discussed two basic questions. Number one, what is your income base? Number two, what are the various ways in which you could meet your maaser obligation? It doesn't have to be cash. It can be by property. It can be by services. It can be by patronizing a poor person and paying more than you would pay for the alternatives. But now, let's discuss perhaps really the most important question that we have to face all the time, and that is, what are the priorities? What do you use maaser money for? It is, of course, very, very clear that there's no way that all of us together could satisfy all of the needs that the Jewish people have and certainly the non-Jewish world has. The question is, choices have to be made, and how do we make those choices? So there are a few things that you need to know. First of all, it's very important to know that there are certain rules regarding mass mailing solicitations that you need to be familiar with. And that is, there is a general rule in halacha that if you are approached by somebody for a face-to-face donation, you are not allowed to turn them away without nothing. However, what you have to give them is absolutely minimal. I mean, we're talking about, the stipend, although I can't believe this, it doesn't make sense to me, but the Stipler Gaon talked about a quarter, a dime, let's say $5, let's say $1. We are really dealing with very minimal amounts. In my experience, they will not take. People will not take that. But the obligation of giving something to everybody who asks can be fulfilled in a very minimal way. It is prohibited to humiliate somebody. It is prohibited to scream at them. It is prohibited to turn your back on them totally, because the verse says in Tehillim, Al Yashov Dach Nichlam, do not turn aside the impoverished to their humiliation and their shame. In fact, if you look at the Rambam, the very famous passage in the Rambam, that talks about the eight levels of giving charity. You go through those levels, you will see that the attitude by which you turn to the poor person to be interested in their plight, not just to write out a check. In other words, if the choice is to be a sympathetic listener and write out a small, relatively small contribution versus giving a lot of money and saying, get out of here, it's very clear that in the laws of tzedakah, the empathy and respect that you show a person actually counts more than the size of your donation. So halacha does not require that you give a lot of money to every single person who asks, although judgments have to be made. I'll talk about those judgments in a moment. Now, when it comes to mail or phone solicitations, Rav Chaim Kanevsky Paskin, that is not the same as a face-to-face solicitation, and they may be ignored. You may, of course, you should read them, because you may discover important and vital causes. But in terms of saying, do I have to respond to every single one? The answer is, you do not. And that is even true if a gift is enclosed. You are halachically permitted to keep the gift and not even respond. It's well known that in mail campaigns, even a 5% response, I mean, it's anticipated there will only be a small response, and that's built into the system. Even a 5% response is considered to be fairly good. So one should not feel guilty if you throw away a lot of mail solicitations. Again, I do think it's important to read them. Number one, it's at least an act of symbolic respect, even though they don't know that. But number two, there are many, many causes that are worthy, and they will work into the prioritization, which I'll talk about in a moment, but there is certainly no absolute rule. You got to respond to every request. I will say this, that requests that do not have letters of, you know, eminent, well-known rabbis or the like should be thrown away. And the reason I say that is because it is so easy to get a letter from an eminent person that if they don't have one, that is actually a cause for suspicion. I'm not saying give if the rabbi gave the letter, but I really think you could almost have a rule of thumb, don't give if the rabbi didn't get a letter, because why shouldn't they have a letter? Everybody can get one, which is another problem. But nevertheless, someone who didn't even bother to get a letter, there is serious question. Now, the halacha is different if it's face-to-face. The halacha says this, face-to-face, somebody rings your doorbell and says, give me food. You don't ask questions. If somebody says they need food, God forbid, you know, they might drop dead on you. I mean, the Gemara has stories of aniyim who drop dead. On the other hand, even in a face-to-face, if it's for a long-term need, you are entitled to ask for verification, which is one of course, the primary function of Tzedakah Inc. We have Rabbi Heinemann's Certificate of Baltimore, the ubiquitous certificate that everybody has seen. Sometimes locally, rabbis here issue certificates as well. And the rule that you have to give somebody something does not preclude a requirement of some type of verification or credential that you're allowed to ask for, unless it's something like food, something in which there's an immediate cheshash of pikuach nefesh. But as I say, if the mail solicitations don't have any corroboration, then I think you could just you can, and I believe perhaps even should, ignore them. Okay. So that's one thing about the phone solicitation and the mail solicitations. Now, having eliminated that, at least in total, let's look at some of the priorities. The priorities are actually fairly clear here. The number one priority is yourself. That old saying, charity begins at home, actually does have a resonance in the laws of tzedakah. And that is, a person must be sure that they are able to maintain their family at a decent standard of living. Now here, let me point out, the Yetzer Hara is very, very strong. When the idea is, be sure that you're taken care of, we don't mean, I'm not going to give charity till I have two vacation homes. I'm not going to give charity until I have the fanciest car. Well, a Jew has to be willing to sacrifice a little bit. I mean, that's why we give. That's why religious Jews are disproportionately audited by the IRS for charitable contributions, because rightly so, we give beyond the national average. That's supposed to be the case. So we're not talking about, I have to have my luxuries before I give to others, but I have to be sure that I have basic economic stability for myself and my family. The next level is parents. You know the old Yiddish saying that one parent takes care of 10 children, but somehow 10 children cannot take care of one parent. Well, there is a mitzvah in the Torah called Kibud Avayim, honoring your parents. Now, strictly speaking, if your parents have the economic resources, you are not obligated to pay for them. Meaning to say, if my parents do not want to do something that's helpful for them, but they have the money, you know, basically it is their responsibility. In fact, there was a story they tell about the great Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Joseph Soloveitchik's grandfather, that a bachor, a yeshiva bachor, was once a little too sharp, and he went to Rav Chaim and said, you know, my parents want me to come home for Pesach, but they haven't sent me the train fare, and I know that Kibud Avayim doesn't require me to spend my own money, so I don't think I have to go visit my parents. So Rav Chaim says, oh, certainly you don't have to spend your own money, so you better start walking. So a person is obligated to spend time with their parents, take care of their parents. Economically, however, if the parents have the resources, the parents pay for it. However, if the parents do not have the resources, it is a halachic obligation on children to take care of their parents. And not only that, you should not use your maser money for that. You should not use your charity money to take care of your parents, unless you're really desperate and you don't have enough for yourself. You should use your regular money to take care of your parents. Chazal even say, a person who supports his parents out of charity funds is considered to be a cursed thing, a person who treats his parents like they were paupers. So taking care of parents is indeed a first priority, but paradoxically, it's not a priority of maser money, because it should come out of regular money and not maser money. Now, what about paying for children? Now, this is a very interesting point. The Gemara has a ruling that's a very, very strange ruling to the modern ear, and it says, parents are obligated to support their children, child support. Sounds good. Until what age is a parent obligated to support a child? Till the age of 6. Once they're 6, go out on your own, make a living, you know. When I was young, you know, etc. Now, that is, you know, fairly bizarre to the modern ear. I mean, you know, child labor laws, you know, even when there was child labor, it wasn't that common necessarily to have 6-year-olds going out and making a living. One wonders about the economic history of Talmudic times. But here is the thing. Halacha is very clear. You cannot use your tzedakah money to support your children below the age of 6, because that's already an obligation that you have as a parent. So you can't use your charity money for things you're obligated to do. Okay. But what about if my child is above 6? According to strict halacha, I'm not obligated to support my kids. It's a matter of charity. Can I use maser money to support my children of the age 6 and above? There actually are opinions that say yes. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein says no. Rav Moshe Feinstein articulates a very important yesod. And this yesod of Rav Moshe is the following. The obligation of parents towards children is to be determined by what is the community acceptable standard. There were historical times, which for every reason, children were independent at a very young age. Today, you know, kids are not independent till what, 30, 40, no, whatever. You know, certainly, at least until 18, there's a legal obligation to provide child support. So therefore, Rabbi Feinstein says, since the parental obligation to take care of my child will exist until at least the age of 18, I cannot use charitable funds to discharge those obligations. It has to come out of my base income, my 90%, so to speak. However, what that does mean is that once your children are legally adults, if they are unable to make a living on their own, then indeed they are like the beneficiaries of any charity, and you can use your maser to help them over hard times. In fact, not only can you use your maser, but they would have priority because the needs of indigent relatives have priority over other poor people. This is especially the case, it's especially virtuous, if you have children who are studying in kollel. So in addition to giving them money because they're poor, you're also giving them money to enable them to study Torah, which is an extra level of mitzvah, and consequently, one is allowed and even encouraged to use their tzedakah money for the support of adult children who are studying Torah. As far as I could see, even if they're just in graduate school or medical school, they might qualify as aniyim, as poor people, and you could give your maaser money for that, but if they're studying Torah, it's even extra. Now, let me point out, though, that this presupposes that your child does not have enough income to have an acceptable standard of living. In other words, if you're just giving your child gifts just to give them extra gifts, they're not poor. If they're not poor, you can't use tzedakah money for, you know, gifts to the grandchildren and the like. But if indeed they could not make a living without your help, again, that needs to be defined as well, then indeed you can use your tzedakah money. Okay. Consequently, for the same reason, you generally cannot use your maaser money to pay day school tuition. This is a common question that people raise. Day school tuition is very expensive, obviously. There are actually some serious proposals in the Jewish community to basically have the whole Jewish community subsidize day school tuition for every Jewish child. It might be a good idea, although it would seem to be very expensive for many people. So the question becomes, can I use the 10% that I set aside for charity? Can I use that to pay my day school tuition? Is there a distinction between a boy and a girl, etc.? So here, once again, Rav Moshe Feinstein does take a strict view on this. And he makes the point that anything which you are already obligated to do, just like, you know, you can't support your parents through maaser money because you have to do it anyway. You can't support your children below 18 through maaser money because you have to do it anyway. You can't call it a charitable thing. So the same thing. Since a parent is obligated to provide their child with a Jewish education, so consequently, it is an obligation of the parent as parents, and one cannot use the maaser money for that. Now, if you give extra contributions, like a banquet donation, of course, you have to deduct the cost of the meal if you go to the banquet, just like the IRS, or if you contribute to the scholarship fund, or even if you want to make a certain accounting, for example, which is a little more difficult, if you are a full tuition parent and a portion of your tuition bill is going to the subsidy of families that cannot afford, you can actually, assuming you can get that apportionment, I'm not sure if you can, you would be able to take that amount off, as it were, as a maaser donation, but not the basic educational expense. Now, people play games with this. In some schools, they allow you to switch tuition, meaning to say, oh, I'm not going to pay my tuition. I'll pay your tuition, and you'll pay my tuition. So each of us is giving charity for the benefit of the other. Once again, halacha does not encourage, although those tricks are sometimes done, halacha does not encourage that type of machination. And generally speaking, a person has to look at the fact that what I pay for Jewish education is my fundamental obligation as a Jew. It is not charity. It is not something extra. It is part of my basic living expense. That is what I do. And consequently, it generally has to come out of the 90%. As opposed, however, if the child is above 18, as I said before, pursuing Jewish education, which might be the case, for example, when you have a senior or someone who's spending Shana Bet in Israel, right, they might already be above 18, that indeed could be considered a charitable contribution under those circumstances. Let me give you a few more examples of this idea that any obligations that you already have, you cannot use as tzedakah contributions. If a person, for example, wants to buy tefillin, you want to buy talis, you want to buy mitzvah objects, you cannot use charitable funds for that because you have to do it anyway. Yes, I could borrow a pair of tefillin if I wanted, but a Jew is supposed to own these things. So you cannot use tzedakah money to purchase mitzvah articles because you're supposed to have these mitzvah articles anyway. Can I use maaser money if I make a pledge to a synagogue building fund? Let's imagine I'm called up to the Torah, and I pledge as a Misha Berich, I'm going to give $18, I'm going to give $36, or I'm solicited by a synagogue building fund. Can I use maaser money? There it's a little different, because keep in mind that you don't have the obligation till you make the promise. It's not like tefillin or chinuch, in which I have a pre-existing obligation. If the obligation arises from my commitment,
if I have in mind when I make the commitment that I'm going to use charity money for that, that defines my commitment. So you see, in other words, if I made the commitment and I didn't think I would use my charity money, so I become obligated, and now I want to use my charity money, can't do it. But if I assume the commitment with the intention that I'm going to use my tzedakah money, I can do that because the commitment is defined by what I assumed. Under those circumstances, I can indeed do that. So it would be advisable, I would think, that when, you don't have to articulate this verbally, but when people make pledges or donations, just to be sure that they're not going to be in the short end of the stick, they should have in mind that if necessary, I will use my charitable funds for these purposes. The one exception to this rule, that you can't use maser money to buy a lulav, to buy an esrog, to buy tefillin, to buy tzitzis, to buy a shofar, is that some opinions say that you can use maser money to buy Jewish books, svarim, if you make them available for people to use. Now, it's a little unclear exactly what form that takes. Obviously, if you buy svarim and donate them to the shul, that's a charitable contribution. But the halacha is, even if you keep your svarim at home, if somehow you communicate that people can come and borrow them, that might be an acceptable use of the money of maser. Some modern poskim don't like that because in the olden days, you know, books were very, very rare. You didn't necessarily have a Beis HaMedrash, which had a lot of books. So consequently, it was a real public resource to buy a shas and say people can come over and use it. Today, you know, every synagogue has a shas. So for me to say, well, I have a shas in my home. If you ever want to use it, just give me a call. You know, it's not so much of a charitable need today because svarim are all over the place. Just to give you an example, though, I mentioned Rav Chaim Soloveitchik before. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, you know, he is known today as the brilliant analytical mind, the founder of the Brisker School of Talmudic thought, extremely profound. But in his lifetime, his greatest fame was because of the loving kindness of his heart. That's a less well-known aspect of Rav Chaim. But he was an extremely kind, compassionate person. And literally, as the Rav of Brisk, his house was open 24 hours a day. There was nothing in his house that he regarded as private property. The only thing was the lulav he didn't give away because halachically you have to own your lulav, so that he didn't allow. Everything else was hefker. People would put up signs and advertisements. There's a story that people would use his svarim all the time. One time his son, the Brisker Rav, Rav Elville, who became a great gadol, his father asked Rav Elville to get a gemara from the bookcase. And when Rav Elville walked into the room, he saw that one of the people who were frequenting the house was using the Gemara. He said, well, you know, my father needs the Gemara now. So the person said to Rav Elville, there's plenty of svarim in the Beis HaMedrash. He can go there and, you know, he basically, you know. And anyway, the story goes, talk about borrowing svarim, that there was a fellow who kept on borrowing svarim from Rav Chaim's library until the bookcase was empty. And then one day, the guy hired a carpenter to dismantle the bookcase. He told Rav Chaim, you know, you don't have any books in your bookcase. I need a bookcase. I have a lot of books. Rav Chaim's books. You know, so that's kind of leaving your home open. We're not requiring that. But if a person does have a difficulty in meeting the maser obligation, there are kind of ways out buying books that are available. Some even say that if you spend money on Shabbos and Yom Tov meals, and you have guests over, you can deduct not your food, but you can deduct the meals of hachnasas orchim, of hospitality. But these, I would have to say, are essentially second-level ways of dealing with maser. They are not optimal. They are there for a person who is suffering a great financial difficulty. So in this way, you could use the maser for various ways. So we talk about yourself, your parents, your children, other relatives. We sometimes forget, you know, we have obligations towards our relatives. Now, it's true that we don't get to choose our relatives, so sometimes our relatives are not the people we like the best in the world. But it's a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Mibsarcha lo tisalein. Do not make yourself invisible to your relatives. If you have a brother, if you have a cousin, if you have a nephew that's going through a financially difficult time, I know that I haven't yet defined that exactly, one should give that person priority over all other types of charity. Not only that, but if you've taken care of yourself, your parents, your children, your relatives, halacha recognizes a geographical preference that the poor people or the needy people, again, I'll try to define that term, in your neighborhood and in your city have preference over needs elsewhere. Which means to say, and this is a controversial issue, that there is a certain priority that must be given to local needs, whether it be taking care of the indigent, whether it be Jewish education, whether it be supporting synagogues or mikvahs or Jewish libraries or the like, that does take precedence over equivalent needs elsewhere. Now, that's a little tricky. You'll notice it said equivalent needs elsewhere. Meaning to say, if I have a request from somebody in another city who needs food versus, let's say, a synagogue building fund to make a nicer shul, under those circumstances, the out-of-town request may have priority because it is a greater urgency. But if the urgencies are equivalent, there has to be a strong precedence or preference that is given to local needs. Now, this raises an interesting problem. That is, what do we mean by priority given to local needs? You know, in my other life, I teach bankruptcy. You know, and in the bankruptcy code, we have priorities. Now, priorities normally means you don't pay a cent to the lesser priority till you take care of the first priority. Now, if that's what priority meant, that would actually mean I give nothing to out-of-town needs until every single local need is taken care of at 100%. If you adopted that definition of priority, then that would mean I should give zilch to out-of-town needs. Well, the Aruch HaShulchan makes the point that that's not exactly what priority means in the laws of charity. In the laws of charity, priority doesn't mean until a need is met at 100%, you give nothing to the next level, but it simply refers to emphasis and direction. And that's where things are not defined very clearly. A person should put a greater emphasis on local needs of equal urgency than out-of-town needs, but he should still leave something over for every worthy need. The question then becomes, so what are the percentages? So again, a rule of thumb that many Rabbanim have suggested, and it really is an arbitrary rule of thumb because I don't see any direct halachic source for this, is they suggest a 2/3, 1/3 allocation in which if you see an equal level of urgency, you should divide your tzedakah money 2/3 local and 1/3 non-local. However, this brings me to another rule, and that is it does say that the poor of the land of Israel are considered to be equivalent to the poor of your community. So essentially, you do have to factor in Aniye Eretz Yisrael as equivalent to Aniye Ircha. And then the Chasam Sofer even says there's a special rule that the poor of Yerushalayim have precedence over that. That's a bit more controversial. Actually, if Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wants to say, well, the poor of Yerushalayim is only the old city, right? It's people who live in Har Nof are not the poor of Yerushalayim. They're only the poor of Eretz Yisrael. So that's a bit of a controversy.